the truth, Mr. Okada?" she said. The voice was no longer Kumiko's. Neither was it the original girlish voice. This was a new voice, which belonged to someone else. It had a poised, intelligent ring to it.
"Just as people don't always meet others in order to reveal their true selves. Do you grasp my meaning, Mr. Okada?"
But still, Kumiko was trying to communicate something to me. Whether or not it was the truth, she was looking to me for something, and that was the truth for me.
I sensed the darkness around me increasing in density, much as the evening tide comes to fullness without a sound. I had to hurry. I didn't have much time left. They might come looking for me here once the lights came back on. I decided to risk putting into words the thoughts that had been slowly forming in my mind.
This is strictly the product of my own imagination, but I would guess that there was some kind of inherited tendency in the Wataya family bloodline. What kind of tendency? I can't be sure, but it was some kind of tendency, something that you were afraid of, which is why you were afraid of having children. When you became pregnant, you panicked because you were worried the tendency would show up in your own child, but you couldn't reveal the secret to me. The whole story started from there.
She said nothing, but quietly placed her glass on the night table. I went on.
"And your sister, I'm sure, didn't die from food poisoning. No, it was more unusual than that. The person responsible for her death was Noboru Wataya, and you know that for a fact. Your sister probably said something to you about it before she died, gave you some kind of warning. Noboru Wataya had some special power, and he knew how to find people who were responsive to that power and to draw something out of them. He must have used that power in a particularly violent way on Krita Kano. She was able, one way or another, to recover, but your sister was not. She lived in the same house, after all. She had nowhere to run to. She couldn't stand it anymore and chose to die. Your parents have always kept her suicide a secret. Isn't that true?"
There was no reply. The woman kept quiet in an attempt to obliterate her presence in the darkness. I went on.
"How we managed to do it and what the occasion was, I have no idea, but at some point, Noboru Wataya increased his violent power geometrically. Through television and the other media, he gained the ability to train his magnified power on society at large. Now he is trying to bring out something that the great mass of people keep hidden in the darkness of their unconscious. He wants to use it for his own political advantage. It's a tremendously dangerous thing, this thing he's trying to draw out. It's fatally smeared with violence and blood, and it has a direct connection with the darkest depths of history, because its final effect is to destroy and obliterate people on a massive scale."
She sighed in the darkness.
"I wonder if I could bother you to pour me another whiskey,"
she asked softly.
I walked over to the night table and picked up her empty glass. I could do that much in the dark without difficulty. I went into the other room and poured a fresh whiskey on the rocks with the aid of the torch.
"What you just said was strictly the product of your own imagination, right?"
she asked. "That's right. I've strung a few ideas together," I said. "There's no way I can prove any of this. I don't have any basis for claiming that what I have said is true."
"But still, I'd like to hear the rest, if there is more to tell."
I went back into the inner room and put the glass on the night table. Then I switched off the torch and returned to my chair. I concentrated my attention on telling the rest of my story.
"You didn't know exactly what had happened to your sister, only that she had given you some kind of warning before she died. You were too young at the time to understand what it was about, but you did understand in a vague sort of way. You knew that Noboru Wataya had somehow defiled and injured your sister, and you sensed the presence in your blood of some kind of dark secret, something from which you could not remain aloof. And so, in that house, you were always alone, always tense, struggling by yourself to live with your dormant, undefinable anxiety like one of those jellyfish we saw in the aquarium. After you graduated from college and after all the trouble with your family, you married me and left the Wataya house. Our life was serene, and with each day that went by, you were able, bit by bit, to forget your dark anxiety. You went out into society a new person as you continued gradually to recover. For a while, it looked as though everything was going to work out for you, but unfortunately, it wasn't that simple. At some point, you noticed that you were being drawn against your will towards that dark force that you thought you had left behind. And when you realized what was happening, you became confused. You didn't know what to do, which is why you went to talk to Noboru Wataya, hoping to learn the truth. And you sought out Malta Kano, hoping that she could give you help. It was only to me that you could not open up. I would guess that all this started after you became pregnant. That, I'm sure, was the turning point, which is probably why I received my first warning from the guitar player in Sapporo the night you had the abortion. Getting pregnant may have stimulated and awakened the dormant something inside you. And that was exactly what Noboru Wataya had been waiting for. That may be the only way he is capable of committing sexually to a woman. That is why he was so determined to drag you back from my side to his once that tendency began to surface in you. He had to have you. Noboru Wataya needed you to play the role your sister had once played for him.
When I finished speaking, a deep silence came to fill the emptiness. I had given voice to everything that my imagination had taught me about Kumiko. Parts of it had come from vague thoughts I had had previously, and the rest had taken shape in my mind while I spoke in the darkness. Perhaps the power of darkness had filled in the blank spots in my imagination. Or perhaps this woman's presence had helped. Either way, there was no solid basis for what I had imagined.
"A very, very interesting story," said the woman.
Again her voice had become the one with the girlish lisp. The speed with which her voice changed seemed to be increasing.
"Well, well, well. So I left you to go into hiding with my defiled body. It's like Waterloo Bridge in the mist, Auld Lang Syne, Robert Taylor, and Vivien Leigh."
"I'm going to take you out of here," I said, cutting her off. "I'm going to take you home, to the world where you belong, where cats with bent tails live, and there are little backyards and alarm clocks ring in the morning."
"And how are you going to do that?"
the woman asked.
"How are you going to take me out of here, Mr. Okada?"
"The way they do in fairy tales," I said. "By breaking the spell."
"Oh, I see,"
said the voice.
"But wait a minute, Mr. Okada. You seem to think that I'm Kumiko. You want to take me home as Kumiko? But what if I'm not Kumiko? What will you do then? You may be preparing to take home someone else entirely. Are you quite sure of what you're doing? Shouldn't you think it over one more time?"
I made a fist around the torch in my pocket. This couldn't possibly be anyone but Kumiko, I thought, but I couldn't prove it. It was ultimately nothing but a hypothesis. Sweat oozed from the hand in my pocket. "I'm going to take you home," I said again, my voice dry. "That's what I came here to do." I heard a movement in the sheets. She was changing her position in the bed.
"Can you say that for sure? Without a doubt?"
she asked, pressing me for confirmation. "Yes, I can say it for sure. I'm going to take you home."
"And you have no second thoughts?"
"No, none. My mind is made up," I said. She followed this with a long silence, as if checking the truth of something. Then, to mark the end of this stage of our conversation, she let out a long breath.
"I'm going to give you a present," she said. "It's not much of a present, but it may come in handy. Don't turn on the light now, but reach over here, very, very slowly, over to the night table."
I left my chair. Engaging the depth of the emptiness, I stretched my right hand out in the dark. I could feel the air's sharp thorns against my fingertips. And then I touched the thing. When I realized what it was, the air seemed to lodge in the back of my throat. The present was a baseball bat. I took hold of the grip and held the bat out straight. It was almost certainly the bat I had taken from the young man with the guitar case. The grip and the weight were right. This had to be it. But as I felt it over more carefully, I found that there was something, some kind of debris, stuck to it just above the brand mark. It felt like a human hair. I took it between my fingertips. Judging from the thickness and hardness, it had to be a real human hair. Several such hairs were stuck to the bat, with what seemed to be congealed blood. Someone had used this bat to smash someone else, probably Noboru Wataya, in the head. It took an effort for me to expel the air caught in my throat.
"That is your bat, isn't it?"
she asked. "I think so," I said, struggling to keep calm. My voice had begun to take on a different tone in the deep darkness, as if someone lurking down here were speaking in my place. I cleared my throat, and after checking to be certain that the one speaking was the real me, I continued. "But somebody seems to have used this to beat someone." The woman kept her mouth sealed. Sitting down, I lowered the bat and held it between my legs. "I'm sure you know what's going on," I said. "Somebody used this bat to crush Noboru Wataya's skull. The news I saw on TV was true. Noboru Wataya is in hospital in a critical condition. He might die."
"He's not going to die,"
said Kumiko's voice without emotion. She might have been reporting a historical fact from a book.
"He may not regain consciousness, though. He may just continue to wander through darkness, but what kind of darkness that would be, no one knows."
I felt for the glass at my feet and picked it up. I poured its contents into my mouth and, without thinking, swallowed. The tasteless liquid passed through my throat and down my gullet. I felt a chill for no reason, then an unpleasant sensation, as if something far away were moving slowly in my direction through a long darkness. As I had known it would, my heart started beating faster.
"We don't have much time," I said. "Just tell me this if you can. Where are we?"
"You've been here before, and you found the way in here, alive and unharmed. You should know where this is, and anyhow, it doesn't matter anymore. The important thing..."
Just then, there was a knock on the door. A hard, dry sound, like someone driving a nail into the wall. Two loud raps, followed by two more. It was the same knock I had heard before. The woman gasped.
"You've got to get out of here,"
she said, in a voice that was unmistakably Kumiko's.
"If you go now, you can still pass through the wall."
I had no idea if what I was thinking was right or wrong, but I knew that as long as I was here, I had to defeat this thing. This was the war that I would have to fight.
"I'm not running away this time," I said to Kumiko. "I'm going to take you home."
I put my glass on the floor, put my woolen hat on, and took the bat from between my knees. Then I started slowly for the door. 35. Just a real knife. The thing that had been prophesied. Lighting my way along the floor and keeping my steps soundless, I moved towards the door. The bat was in my right hand. I was still walking when the knocks came again. Two knocks, then two more. Harder this time and more violent. I pressed myself against the side wall where I would be hidden by the door when it opened. There I waited, keeping my breath in check. When the sound of the knocks faded, a deep silence descended over everything again, as if nothing had happened. But I could feel the presence of someone on the other side of the door. This someone was standing there the way I was, keeping his breath in check and listening, trying to hear the sound of breathing or the beating of a heart, or to read the movement of a thought. I tried to keep my breath from agitating the surrounding air. "I am not here," I told myself. "I am not here. I am not anywhere." The key turned in the lock. He performed each movement with the utmost caution, drawing out the time it took to perform any one act so that the sounds involved would become isolated from each other, their meaning lost. The doorknob turned, and this was followed by the almost imperceptible sound of hinges rotating. The contractions of my heart began to speed up. I tried to quell the disturbance this caused, but without success. Someone came into the room, sending ripples through the air. I made a conscious effort to sharpen each of my five senses and caught the faint smell of a foreign body, a strange mixture of thick clothing, suppressed breathing, and overwrought nerves steeped in silence. Did he have the knife in his hand? I had to assume that he did. I remembered its vivid white gleam. Holding my breath, obliterating my presence, I tightened my grip on the bat. Once inside, the someone closed the door and locked it. Then he stood there, back to the door, watching and waiting. My hands on the bat were drenched with sweat. I would have liked to wipe my palms on my trousers, but the slightest movement could have had fatal results. I brought to mind the sculpture that had stood in the garden of the abandoned Miyawaki house. In order to obliterate my presence here, I made myself one with that image of a bird. There, in the sun-drenched summer garden, I was the sculpture of a bird, frozen in space, glaring at the sky. The someone had brought his own torch. He switched it on, and its straight, narrow beam cut through the darkness. The light was not strong. It came from the same kind of penlight I was carrying.
I waited for the beam to pass me as he walked into the room, but he made no effort to move.
The light began to pick out items in the room, one after another. The flowers in the vase, the silver tray lying on the table, giving off its sensual gleam, the sofa, the floor lamp. It swung past my nose and came to rest on the floor a few inches beyond the tips of my shoes, licking every corner of the room like the tongue of a snake. I waited for what felt like an eternity. Fear and tension drilled into my consciousness with intense pain. "No thinking. You are not allowed to think," I told myself. "You are not allowed to use your imagination." Lieutenant Mamiya had said that in his letter. "Imagining things here can be fatal." Finally, the torch beam began to move forward slowly, very slowly. The man seemed to be heading for the inner room. I tightened my grip on the bat. It was then I noticed that the sweat of my hands had dried. If anything, my hands were now too dry. The man took one slow step forward, then stopped, then one more. He seemed to be checking his footing. He was closer to me than ever now. I took a breath and held it. Two more steps, and he would be where I wanted him. Two more steps, and I would be able to put an end to this walking nightmare. But then, without warning, the light disappeared. Total darkness swallowed everything again. He had turned off his torch. I tried to make my mind work quickly in the dark, but it would not work at all. An unfamiliar chill ran through me. He had realized that I was there. "Move," I told myself. "Don't just stand there." I tried to dodge to the left, but my legs would not move. My feet were stuck to the floor like the feet of the bird sculpture. I bent forward and barely managed to incline my stiffened upper body to the left. Just then, something slammed into my right shoulder, and something hard and cold as frozen rain stabbed me to the bone. The impact seemed to revive me, and the paralysis disappeared from my legs. I sprang to the left and crouched in the darkness, feeling for my opponent. The blood was pounding through my body, every muscle and cell straining for oxygen. My right shoulder was going numb, but I had no pain. That would come later. I stayed absolutely still, and he did too. We faced each other in the darkness, holding our breaths. There was nothing to see, nothing to hear. Again, without warning, the knife came. It slashed past my face like an attacking bee, the sharp point just catching my right cheek where the mark was. I could feel the skin tearing. No, he could not see me either. If he could, he would have finished me off long before. I swung the bat in the darkness, aiming in the direction from which the knife had come, but it just swished through the air, striking nothing. The swing had been a good one, though, and the crisp sound helped me to loosen up somewhat. We were still an even match. The knife had cut me twice, but not badly. Neither of us could see the other, and though he had a knife, I had my bat. Again, in our mutual blindness, breathing held in check, we felt each other out, waiting for some hint of movement. I could feel blood dripping down my face, but I was free of fear. "It's just a knife," I said to myself. "It's just a cut." I waited. I waited for the knife to come my way again. I could wait forever. I drew my breath in and expelled it without a sound.
Come on, I said to him in my mind. Move! I'm waiting for you to move. Stab me if you want to. I'm not afraid. Again the knife came. It slashed the collar of my sweater. I could feel the point moving past my throat, but it didn't touch my skin. I twisted and jumped to the side, and almost too impatient to straighten up, I swung the bat through space. It caught him somewhere around the collarbone. Not enough to bring him down or break any bones, but I knew I had hurt him. I could feel him recoil from the blow, and I heard a loud gasp. I took a short backswing and went for him again, in the same direction at a slightly higher angle where I had heard his breath draw in. It was a perfect swing. I caught him somewhere high on the neck. There was a sickening sound of cracking bone. A third swing hit home, the skull, and sent him flying. He let out a strange sound and slumped to the floor. He lay there, making little gasps, but those soon stopped. I closed my eyes and, without thinking, aimed one final swing in the direction of the sound. I didn't want to do it, but I had no choice. I had to finish him off, not out of hatred or even out of fear, but as something I simply had to do. I heard something crack open in the darkness like a piece of fruit, like a watermelon. I stood still, gripping the bat, holding it out in front of me. Then I realized I was trembling all over, and there was no way I could stop it. I took a step back and pulled the torch from my pocket.
"Don't!"
cried a voice in the darkness.
"Don't look at it!"
Kumiko's voice was calling to me from the inner room, trying to stop me from looking. But I had to look. I had to see it. I had to know what it was, this thing in the center of the darkness that I had just beaten to a pulp. Part of me understood what Kumiko was forbidding me to do. She was right. I shouldn't look at it. But I had the torch in my hand now, and that hand was moving on its own.
"Please, I'm begging you to stop!"
she screamed.
"Don't look at it if you want to take me home again!"
I clenched my teeth and quietly released the air I had locked in my lungs. Still, the trembling would not subside. A sickening smell hung in the air, the smell of brains and violence and death. I had done this. I was the one who had made the air smell like this. I found the sofa and collapsed onto it. For a while, I fought against the nausea rising in my stomach, but the nausea won. I vomited everything in my stomach onto the carpet, and when that was gone, I brought up stomach fluid, then air and saliva. While vomiting, I dropped the bat on the floor. I could hear it rolling away in the darkness. Once the spasms of my stomach began to subside, I wanted to take out my handkerchief to wipe my mouth, but I could not move my hand. I couldn't get up from the sofa. "Let's go home," I said towards the darkness of the inner room. "This is all over now. Let's go." She didn't answer. There was no one in there anymore. I sank into the sofa and closed my eyes. I could feel the strength going out of me, from my fingers, my shoulders, my neck, my legs. The pain of my wounds began to fade as well. My body was losing all sense of mass and substance. But this gave me no anxiety, no fear at all. Without protest, I gave myself up, surrendered my flesh to some huge, warm thing that came naturally to enfold me. I realized then that I was passing through the wall of jelly. All I had to do was give myself up to the gentle flow. "I'll never come back here again," I said to myself as I moved through the wall. Everything had come to an end. But where was Kumiko? Where did she go? I was supposed to bring her back from the room. That was the reason I had killed a man. That was the reason I had to split his skull open like a watermelon. That was the reason I... But I couldn't think anymore. My mind was sucked into a deep pool of nothingness. When I came to, I was sitting in the darkness again. My back was against the wall, as always. I had returned to the bottom of the well. But it was not the usual well bottom. There was something new here, something unfamiliar. I tried to gather my faculties to grasp what was going on. What was so different? But my senses were still in a state of near total paralysis. I had only a partial, fragmentary sense of my surroundings. I felt as if, through some error, I had been deposited in the wrong container. After a time, though, I began to realize what it was. Water. I was surrounded by water. The well was no longer dry. I was sitting in water up to my waist.
I took several deep breaths to calm myself. How could this be? The well was producing water, not cold water, though. If anything, it felt warm. I felt as if I were soaking in a heated pool. It then occurred to me to check my pocket. I wanted to know if the torch was still there. Had I brought it back with me from the other world? Was there any link between what had happened there and this reality? But my hand would not move. I couldn't even move my fingers. All strength had gone out of my arms and legs. It was impossible for me to stand. I began a cool-headed assessment of my situation. First of all, the water came up only to my waist, so I didn't have to worry about drowning. True, I was unable to move, but that was probably because I had used up every ounce of strength. Once sufficient time had passed, my strength would come back. The knife wounds didn't seem very deep, and the paralysis at least saved me from having to suffer pain. The blood seemed to have stopped flowing from my cheek. I leaned my head back against the wall and told myself, "It's okay, don't worry." Everything had ended. All I had to do now was give my body some rest, then go back to my original world, the world above ground, where the sunlight overflowed. But why had this well started producing water all of a sudden? It had been dried up, dead, for such a long time, yet now it had come back to life. Could this have some connection with what I had accomplished there? Yes, it probably did. Something might have loosened whatever it was that had been obstructing the vein of water. Shortly after that, I encountered one ominous fact. At first, I tried to resist accepting it as a fact. My mind came up with a range of possibilities that would enable me to do that. I tried to convince myself that it was an hallucination caused by the combination of darkness and fatigue, but in the end, I had to recognize the truth. However hard I attempted to deceive myself, it would not go away. The water level was rising. The water had risen now from my waist to the underside of my bent knees. It was happening slowly, but it was happening. I tried again to move my body. With a concentrated effort, I tried to squeeze out whatever strength I could manage, but it was useless. The most I could do was bend my neck a little. I looked overhead. The well lid was still solidly in place. I tried to look at the watch on my left wrist without success. The water was coming in from an opening, and with what seemed like increasing speed. Where it had been barely seeping in at first, it was now almost gushing. I could hear it. Soon it was up to my chest. How deep was it going to get? "Be careful of water," Mr. Honda had said to me. I had not given any credence to his prophecy. True, I had not forgotten it either. You don't forget anything as weird as that. But I had never taken it seriously. Mr. Honda had been nothing more than a harmless episode for Kumiko and me. I would repeat his words as a joke now and then when something came up. "Be careful of water," and we would laugh. We were young and we had no need for prophecies. Just living was itself an act of prophecy. But Mr. Honda had been right. I almost wanted to laugh out loud. The water was rising and I was in trouble. I thought about Mei Kasahara. I used my imagination to picture her opening the well cover with total reality and clarity. The image was so real and clear that I could have stepped right into it. I couldn't move my body, but my imagination still worked. What else could I do?
"Hey, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,"
said Mei Kasahara. Her voice reverberated up and down the well shaft. I hadn't realized that a well with water echoed more than one without water.
"What are you doing down there, thinking again?"
"I'm not doing any one thing in particular," I said, facing upward. "I haven't got time to explain now, but I can't move my body and the water is rising in here. This isn't a dry well anymore. I might drown."
"Poor Mr. Wind-Up Bird," said Mei Kasahara. "You emptied yourself out trying so hard to save Kumiko, and you probably did save her, right? And in the process, you saved lots of people, but you couldn't save yourself, and nobody else could save you. You used up your strength and your fate saving others. All your seeds were planted somewhere else, and now your bag is empty. Have you ever heard of anything so unfair? I feel sympathy for you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, from the bottom of my heart. It's true. But finally, it was a choice you made yourself. Do you know what I mean?"
"I do,"
I said. I felt a dull throb in my right shoulder. It really happened then, I told myself. The knife really cut me. It cut me as a real knife.
Are you afraid to die, Mr. Wind-Up Bird?
Asked May Kasahara.
Sure I am,
I said. I could hear my voice reverberating in the well. It was my voice, and at the same time it wasn't.
Sure I'm afraid when I think about dying down here in a dark well.
Goodbye then, poor Mr. Wind-Up Bird, said May Kasahara. Sorry there's nothing I can do for you. I'm far, far away.
Goodbye, May Kasahara, I said. You look great in a bikini.
May Kasahara's voice was very quiet as she said,
Goodbye, poor Mr. Wind-Up Bird.
The well cover closed tightly again. The image faded, but nothing happened. The image was not linked to anything. I shouted towards the well mouth.
May Kasahara! Where are you now that I need you?
The water was up to my throat. Now it was wrapped around my neck like a noose. In anticipation, I was beginning to find it difficult to breathe. My heart, now under water, was working hard to tick off the time that remained to it. At this rate, I would have another 5 minutes or so before the water covered my mouth and nose and started filling my lungs. There was no way I could win. I had brought this well back to life, and I would die in its rebirth. It was not a bad way to die, I told myself. The world is full of much worse ways to die. I closed my eyes and tried to accept my impending death as calmly as I could. I struggled to overcome my fear. At least I was able to leave a few things behind. That was the one small bit of good news. I tried to smile without much success. I am afraid to die, though, I whispered to myself. These turned out to be my last words. They were not very impressive words, but it was too late to change them. The water was over my mouth now. Then it came up to my nose. I stopped breathing. My lungs fought to suck in new air, but there was no more air. There was only lukewarm water. I was dying. Like all the other people who live in this world.
36. The Story of the Duck People. Shadows and Tears. May Kasahara's Point of View, 6.
Hi again, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. Hey, are these letters reaching you? I mean, I've been writing you tons and tons of letters, and I'm starting to wonder if they ever arrive. The address I've been using is a kind of thing, and I don't put a return address on the envelope, so maybe they're just piling up on the little letter lost shelf in a post office somewhere, unread and all covered with dust. Up to now, I figured, okay, if they're not getting through, they're not getting through, so what? I've been scratching away at these things, but the important thing was for me to put my thoughts down on paper. It's easy for me to write if I think I'm writing to you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. I don't know why. Hey, yeah, why is that? But this letter is one I really want you to read. I hope and pray it gets to you. Now I'm going to write about the duck people. Yes, I know this is the first time I've mentioned them, but here goes. I told you before how this factory I'm working in has this huge property with woods and a pond and stuff. It's great for taking walks. The pond's a pretty big one, and that's where the duck people live, maybe 12 birds altogether. I don't know how their family is organized. I suppose they've got their internal arrangements, with some members getting along better with some and not so well with others, but I've never seen them fight. It's December, so ice has started to form on the pond, but not such thick ice. Even when it's cold, there's still enough open water left for the ducks to swim around a little bit. When it's cold enough for thick ice, I'm told, some of the girls come here to ice skate. Then the duck people, yes, I know it's a weird expression, but I've got into the habit of using it, so it just comes out. We'll have to go somewhere else. I don't like ice skating, so I'm hoping there won't be any ice, but I don't think it's going to do any good. I mean, it gets really cold in this part of the country, so as long as they go on living here, the duck people are going to have to resign themselves to it. I come here every weekend these days and kill time watching the duck people. When I'm doing that, 2 or 3 hours can go by before I know it. I go out in the cold, armed head to foot like some kind of polar bear hunter, tights, hat, scarf, boots, fur-trimmed coat, and I spend hours sitting on a rock all by myself, chilling out, watching the duck people. Sometimes I feed them old bread. Of course, there's nobody else here with the time to do such crazy things. You may not know this, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, but ducks are very pleasant people to spend time with. I never get tired of watching them. I'll never understand why everybody else bothers to go somewhere far away and pay good money to see some stupid movie instead of enjoying these people. Like sometimes they'll come flapping through the air and land on the ice, but their feet slide and they fall over. It's like a TV comedy. They make me laugh even with nobody else around. Of course they're not clowning around trying to make me laugh. They're doing their best to live very serious lives, and they just happen to fall down sometimes. I think that's cool. The duck people have these flat orange feet that are really cute, like they're wearing little kids' rain boots, but they're not made for walking on ice, I guess, because I see them slipping and sliding all over the place, and some even fall on their bottoms. They must not have non-slip treads. So winter is not really a fun season for the duck people. I wonder what they think deep down inside about ice and stuff. I bet they don't hate it all that much. It just seems that way to me from watching them. They look like they're living happily enough, even if it's winter, probably just grumbling to themselves. Ice again! Oh, well! That's another thing I really like about the duck people. The pond is in the middle of the woods, far from everything. Nobody but me, of course, bothers to walk all the way over here at this time of year, except on unusually warm days. I walk down the path through the woods, and my boots crunch on the ice that's left from a recent snowfall. I see lots of birds all around. When I've got my collar up and my scarf wrapped round and round under my chin, and my breath makes white puffs in the air, and I've got a chunk of bread in my pocket, and I'm walking down the path in the woods, thinking about the duck people, I get this really warm, happy feeling, and it hits me that I haven't felt happy like this for a long, long time. Okay, that's enough about the duck people. To tell you the truth, I woke up an hour ago from a dream about you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, and I've been sitting here, writing you this letter. Right now, it's... I look at my clock. Exactly 2:18 a.m. I got into bed just before 10 o'clock, as usual, said good night, everybody, to the duck people, and fell fast asleep. But then, a little while ago, I woke up. Bang! Actually, I'm not sure it was a dream. I mean, I don't remember anything I was dreaming about. Maybe I wasn't dreaming, but whatever it was, I heard your voice right next to my ear. You were calling to me over and over in this really loud voice. That's what shocked me awake. The room wasn't dark when I opened my eyes. Moonlight was pouring through the window. This great big moon, like a stainless steel tray, was hanging over the hill. It was so huge, it looked as if I could have reached out and written something on it. And the light coming in through the window looked like a big white pool of water. I sat up in bed, racking my brains, trying to figure out what had just happened. Why had you been calling my name in such a sharp, clear voice? My heart kept pounding for the longest time. If I had been in my own house, I would have got dressed, even if it was the middle of the night, and run down the alley to your house, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. But out here, a million miles away in the mountains, I couldn't run anywhere, right? So then you know what I did? I got naked. Don't ask me why. I'm really not sure myself, so just be quiet and listen to the rest. Anyhow, I took every stitch of clothing off and got out of bed, and I got down on my knees on the floor in the white moonlight. The heating was off, and the room must have been cold, but I didn't feel cold. There was some kind of special something in the moonlight that was coming in at the window, and it was wrapping my body in a thin, protective, skin-tight film. At least that's how I felt. I just stayed there naked for a while, but then I took turns holding different parts of my body out to be bathed in the moonlight. I don't know, it just seemed like the most natural thing to do. The moonlight was so absolutely incredibly beautiful that I couldn't not do it. My head and shoulders and arms and breasts and tummy and legs and bottom and, you know, around there, one after another, I dipped them in the moonlight like taking a bath. If somebody had seen me from outside, they'd have thought it was very, very strange. I must have looked like some kind of full moon pervert going bonkers in the moonlight. But nobody saw me, of course. Though come to think of it, maybe that boy on the motorcycle was somewhere looking at me. But that's okay. He's dead. If he wanted to look, and if he'd be satisfied with that, I'd be glad to let him see me. But anyhow, nobody was looking at me. I was doing it all alone in the moonlight. And every once in a while, I close my eyes and think about the duck people, who were probably sleeping near the pond somewhere. I think about the warm, happy feeling that the duck people and I had created together in the daytime. Because finally, the duck people are an important kind of magic, kind of protective amulet kind of thing for me. I stayed kneeling there for a long time after that, just kneeling all alone, all naked in the moonlight. The light gave my skin a magical color.
color, and it threw a sharp black shadow of my body across the floor all the way to the wall. It didn't look like the shadow of my body, but one that belonged to a much more mature woman. It wasn't a virgin like me. It didn't have my corners and angles, but was fuller and rounder with much bigger breasts and nipples. But it was the shadow that I was making, just stretched out longer, with a different shape. When I moved, it moved. For a while, I tried moving in different ways and watching very, very carefully to see what the connection was between me and my shadow, trying to figure out why it should look so different. But I couldn't figure it out. The more I looked, the stranger it seemed. Now, here comes the part that's really hard to explain, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. I doubt if I can do it, but here goes. Well, to cut a long story short, all of a sudden I burst into tears. I mean, if it was in a screenplay or something, it'd go, "May Kasahara, here with no warning, covers face with hands, wails aloud, collapses in tears." But don't be too shocked. I've been hiding it from you all this time. But in fact, I'm the world's biggest crybaby. I cry for anything. It's my secret weakness. So for me, the fact that I burst out crying for no reason at all was not such a surprise. Usually, though, I just have myself a little cry, and then I tell myself it's time to stop. I cry easily, but I stop just as easily. Tonight, though, I just couldn't stop. The cork popped, and that was that. I didn't know what had started me, so I didn't know how to stop myself. The tears just came gushing out like blood from a huge wound. I couldn't believe the amount of tears I was producing. I seriously started to worry I might get dehydrated and turn into a mummy if this kept up. I could actually see and hear my tears dripping down into the white pool of moonlight, where they were sucked in as if they had always been part of the light. As they fell, the tears caught the light of the moon and sparkled like beautiful crystals. Then I noticed that my shadow was crying too, shedding clear, sharp shadow tears. Have you ever seen the shadows of tears, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? They're nothing like ordinary shadows, nothing at all. They come here from some other distant world, especially for our hearts. Or maybe not. It struck me then that the tears my shadow was shedding might be the real thing, and the tears that I was shedding were just shadows. You don't get it, I'm sure, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. When a naked 17-year-old girl is shedding tears in the moonlight, anything can happen. It's true. So that's what happened in this room about an hour ago, and now I'm sitting at my desk, writing a letter to you in pencil, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, with my clothes on, of course. Bye-bye, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. I don't quite know how to put this, but the duck people in the woods and I are praying for you to be warm and happy. If anything happens to you, don't hesitate to call me out loud again. Good night.
37. Two different kinds of news. The thing that disappeared.
"Cinnamon carried you here," said Nutmeg.
The first thing that came to me when I woke was pain in different twisted forms. The knife wound gave me pain, and all the joints and bones and muscles in my body gave me pain. Different parts of my body must have slammed up against things as I fled through the darkness, and yet the form of each of these different pains was still not quite right. They were somewhere close to pain, but they could not exactly be called pain. Next, I realized that I was stretched out on the fitting room sofa, wearing navy blue pajamas that I had never seen before, and covered with a blanket. The curtains were open, and bright morning sun streamed through the window. I guessed it must be around 10 o'clock. There was fresh air here, and time that moved forward, but why such things existed, I could not quite comprehend.
"Cinnamon brought you here," said Nutmeg. "Your wounds are not that bad. The one on your shoulder is fairly deep, but it didn't hit any major blood vessels, fortunately. The ones on your face are just scrapes. Cinnamon used a needle and thread to sew up the others so you won't have scars. He's good at that. You can take the stitches out yourself in a few days or have a doctor do it."
I tried to speak, but I couldn't make my voice work. All I could do was inhale and let the air out as a rasping sound.
"You'd better not try to move or talk yet," said Nutmeg.
She was sitting on a nearby chair with her legs crossed.
"Cinnamon says you were in the well too long. It was a very close call. But don't ask me what happened. I don't know a thing. I got a call in the middle of the night, phoned for a taxi, and flew over here. The details of what went on before that I just don't know. Your clothes were soaking wet and bloody. We threw them away."
Nutmeg was dressed more simply than usual, as if she had indeed rushed out of the house. She wore a cream-colored cashmere sweater over a man's striped shirt and a woolen skirt of olive green, no jewelry, and her hair was tied back. She looked a little tired, but otherwise could have been a photo in a catalog. She put a cigarette between her lips and lit it with her gold lighter, making the usual clean, dry click, then inhaling with eyes narrowed. I really had not died, I reassured myself when I heard the sound of the lighter. Cinnamon must have pulled me out of the well in the nick of time.
Cinnamon understands things in a special way, said Nutmeg. And unlike you or me, he's always thinking very deeply about the potential for things to happen. But not even he imagined that water would come back to the well so suddenly. It had simply not been among the many possibilities he had considered, and because of that you almost lost your life. It was the first time I ever saw that boy panic.
She managed a little smile when she said that.
He must really like you, she said.
I couldn't hear what she said after that. I felt an ache deep behind my eyes, and my eyelids grew heavy. I let them close, and I sank down into darkness, as if on a lift ride. It took 2 full days for my body to recover. Nutmeg stayed with me the whole time. I couldn't get up by myself, I couldn't speak, I could hardly eat. The most I could manage was a few sips of orange juice and a few slivers of canned peaches. Nutmeg would go home at night and come back in the morning, which was fine, because I was out cold all night, and most of the day, too. Sleep was obviously what I needed most for my recovery. I never saw Cinnamon. He seemed to be consciously avoiding me. I would hear his car coming in through the gate whenever he dropped Nutmeg off or picked her up or delivered food or clothing, hear that special deep rumble that Porsche engines make, since he had stopped using the Mercedes, but he didn't come inside. He handed things to Nutmeg at the front door, then left.
"We'll be getting rid of this place soon," Nutmeg said to me. "I'll have to take care of the women again myself. Oh, well, I guess it's my fate. I'll just have to keep going until I'm all used up. Empty. And you probably won't be having anything to do with us anymore. When this is all over and you're well again, you'd better forget about us as soon as you can, because... Oh, yes, I forgot to tell you. About your brother-in-law, Noboru Wataya."
Nutmeg brought a newspaper from the next room and unfolded it on the table.
"Cinnamon brought this a little while ago. Your brother-in-law collapsed last night in Nagasaki. They took him to a hospital there, but he's been unconscious ever since. They don't know if he'll recover."
Nagasaki? I could hardly comprehend what she was saying. I wanted to speak, but the words would not come out. Noboru Wataya should have collapsed in Akasaka, not Nagasaki. Why Nagasaki?
"He gave a speech in Nagasaki," Nutmeg continued, "and he was having dinner with the organizers afterwards, when all of a sudden he went limp. They took him to a nearby hospital. They think it was some kind of stroke, probably some congenital weakness in a blood vessel in his brain. The paper says he'll be bedridden for some time, that even if he regains consciousness he probably won't be able to speak, so that's pretty much the end of his political career. What a shame. He was so young. I'll leave the paper here. You can read it when you're feeling better."
It took me a while to absorb these facts as facts. The images from the TV news I had seen in the hotel lobby were still too vividly burned into my brain. Noboru Wataya's office in Akasaka, the police all over the place, the front door of the hospital, the reporter grim, his voice tense. Little by little, though, I was able to convince myself that what I had seen was news that existed only in the other world. I had not, in actuality, in this world, beaten Noboru Wataya with a baseball bat. I would not, in actuality, be investigated by the police or arrested for the crime. He had collapsed in public, in full view, from a stroke. There was no crime involved, no possibility of a crime. This knowledge came to me as a great relief. After all, the assailant described on television had borne a startling resemblance to me, and I had no alibi. There had to be some connection between my having beaten someone to death in the other world and Noboru Wataya's collapse. I clearly killed something inside him, or something powerfully linked with him. He might have sensed that it was coming. What I had done, though, had failed to take Noboru Wataya's life. He had managed to survive on the brink of death. I should have pushed him over the brink. What would happen to Kumiko now? Would she be able to break free while he was still alive? Would he continue to cast his spell over her from his unconscious darkness? That was as far as my thoughts would take me. My own consciousness slipped away bit by bit until I closed my eyes in sleep. I had a tense, fragmentary dream. Krita Kana was holding a baby to her breast. I could not see the baby's face. Krita Kana's hair was short, and she wore no makeup. She told me that the baby's name was Corsica, and that half the baby's father was me, while the other half was Lieutenant Mamiya. She had not gone to Crete, she said, but had remained in Japan to bear and raise the child. She had only recently been able to find a new name for the baby, and now she was living a peaceful life growing vegetables in the hills of Hiroshima with Lieutenant Mamiya. None of this came as a surprise to me. In my dream, at least, I had foreseen it all. "How has Maltacano been since I last saw her?" I asked. Krita Kano did not reply to this. Instead, she gave me a sad look, and then she disappeared. On the morning of the third day, I was at last able to get out of bed by myself. Walking was still too hard for me, but I slowly regained the ability to speak. Nutmeg made me rice gruel. I ate that and a little fruit. "How is the cat doing?" I asked her. This had been a matter of concern for me for some time.
"Don't worry, Cinnamon is looking after him. He goes to your house every day to feed him and change his water. The only thing you have to worry about is yourself."
"When are you going to get rid of this place?"
"As soon as we can. Probably sometime next month. I think you'll be seeing a little money from it, too. We'll probably have to let it go for something less than we paid for it, so you won't get much, but your share should be a good percentage of what you paid on the mortgage. That should support you for a while. So you don't have to worry too much about money. You deserve it, after all. You worked hard here."
"Is this house going to be torn down?"
"Probably. And they'll fill in the well. Which seems like a waste now that it's producing water again, but nobody wants a big, old-fashioned well like that these days. They usually just put in a pipe and an electric pump. It's a lot more convenient, and it takes up less space."
"I don't suppose this place is jinxed anymore," I said. "It'll be just an ordinary piece of property again, not the hanging house."
"You may be right,"
said Nutmeg. She hesitated, then bit her lip.
"But that no longer has anything to do with me or with you, right? In any case, the important thing is for you to rest now and not bother with things that don't really matter. It will take a while until you're fully recovered."
Nutmeg showed me the article on Noboru Wataya in the morning paper she had brought with her. It was a small piece. Still unconscious, Noboru Wataya had been transferred from Nagasaki to a large university hospital in Tokyo, where he was in intensive care, his condition unchanged. The report said nothing more than that. What crossed my mind at that point was, of course, Kumiko. Where could she be? I had to get back home, but I still lacked the strength to walk such a distance. I made it as far as the bathroom basin late the next morning and saw myself in the mirror for the first time in 3 days. I looked terrible, less like a tired living being than a well-preserved corpse. As Nutmeg had said, the cut on my cheek had been sewn up with professional-looking stitches, the edges of the wound held in good alignment by white thread. It was at least an inch in length, but not very deep. It pulled if I tried to make a face, but there was little pain. I brushed my teeth and used an electric shaver on my beard. I couldn't trust myself to handle a razor yet.
As the whiskers came off, I could hardly believe what I was seeing in the mirror. I put the shaver down and took a good look. The mark was gone. The man had cut my right cheek exactly where the mark had been. The cut was there all right, but the mark was gone. It had disappeared from my cheek without a trace. During the night of the fifth day, I heard the faint sound of sleigh bells again. It was a little after 2 in the morning. I got up from the sofa, slipped a cardigan over my pajamas, and left the fitting room. Passing through the kitchen, I went to Cinnamon's small office and peeked inside. Cinnamon was calling to me again from inside the computer. I sat down at the desk and read the message on the screen. "You have now gained access to the program The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. Choose a document, 1 to 17. I clicked on number 17, and a document opened up before me. 38. The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, number 17. Kumiko's letter.
There are many things I have to tell you. To tell them all would take a very long time, maybe years. I should have opened up to you long ago, confessed everything to you, but unfortunately I lacked the courage to do so. And I still harbored the groundless hope that things would not turn out so badly. The result has been this nightmare for us both. It's all my fault. But it is also too late for explanations. We don't have enough time for that. So what I want to do here is tell you the most important thing first. And that is, I have to kill my brother, Noboru Wataya. I am going to go now to the hospital room where he is sleeping to pull the plug on his life support system. As his sister, I will be allowed to stay the night with him in place of a nurse. It will be a while before anyone notices that he has been disconnected. I got the doctor to show me yesterday how it works. I intend to wait until I am sure he is dead, and then I will give myself up to the police. I will tell them I did what I thought was right, but offer no more explanation than that. I will probably be arrested on the spot and tried for murder. The media will leap in, and people will offer opinions on death with dignity and other such matters. But I will keep silent. I will offer no explanation or defense. There is only one truth in all this, and that is that I wanted to end the life of a single human being, Noboru Wataya. They will lock me up, but the prospect doesn't frighten me. I have already been through the worst. If it hadn't been for you, I would have lost my mind long ago. I would have handed myself over, vacant, to someone else and fallen to a point beyond hope of recovery. My brother, Noboru Wataya, did exactly that to my sister many years ago, and she ended up killing herself. He defiled us both. Strictly speaking, he did not defile our bodies. What he did was even worse than that. The freedom to do anything at all was taken from me, and I shut myself up in a dark room alone. No one chained me down or set a guard to watch over me, but I could not have escaped. My brother held me with yet stronger chains and guards that were myself. I was the chain that bit into my ankle, and I was the ruthless guard that never slept. Inside me, of course, there was a self that wanted to escape. But at the same time, there was a cowardly, debauched self that had given up all hope of ever being able to flee from there, and the first self could never dominate the second because I had been so defiled in mind and body. I had lost the right to go back to you, not just because I had been defiled by my brother Noboru Wataya, but because even before that, I had defiled myself irreparably. I told you in my letter that I had slept with another man. But in that letter I was not telling the truth. I must confess the truth to you here. I did not sleep with just one man. I slept with many other men. Too many to count. I myself have no idea what caused me to do such a thing. Looking back upon it now, I think it may have been my brother's influence. He may have opened some kind of drawer inside me, taken out some kind of incomprehensible something, and made me give myself to one man after another. My brother had that kind of power, and as much as I hate to acknowledge it, the two of us were surely tied together in some dark place. In any case, by the time my brother came to me, I had already defiled myself beyond all cleansing. In the end, I even contracted a venereal disease.